At 6'2", Julia Child dominated every kitchen in which she worked, but her height was exceeded by the good-natured charm, boundless enthusiasm, and effortless technique that made her TV's first cooking star. A new biography, timed for the centennial of her birth, argues that Julia Child's book, Mastering the Art of French Cooking, redefined the notion of fine food for a generation of American women. It convinced them there was art and science to their most common household chore. Her cooking on educational TV showed that great cooking could be fun, especially with a glass of wine. The remarkable life of Julia Child, next on Midday, after the news. And welcome back to Midday, everyone. Our second hour, Dan Roderick's here. In a TV age of iron chefs, restaurant makeover tyrants, and wannabe cooking stars, consider this. Only one chef has her kitchen on display in the Smithsonian's Museum of American History. This year marks the 100th anniversary of her birth, and Julia Child's legend lives on thanks to the magic of videotape and 47 printings of her legendary book, her first book, Mastering the Art of French Cooking. For a generation of housewives who grew up in the Velveeta belt of the 1950s America, Julia Child had a revolutionary message. Great cooking can be an art, a science, a challenge, and above all, great fun, especially with a glass of wine. A year after Mastering the Art of French Cooking was published, Julia Child became America's first kitchen star, with a public television show called The French Chef. It was the first of 8 cooking series and many specials she would host over the years.
Hello, I'm Julia Child. Welcome to The French Chef and the first show on our series on French cooking. We're going to make bœuf bourguignon, beef stew, and red wine. And it's a wonderful show to begin our series on because it shows you so many useful things about French cooking. How to brown meat, how to braise onions, how to sauté mushrooms, how to make a wonderful sauce. And you make a bœuf bourguignon just the way you make any other kind of a stew, like chicken coq au vin. You can make lamb this way or veal this way. And now here's our beef. And I've made quite
In 2009, Meryl Streep portrayed Julia Child on the big screen. And now author Bob Spitz has produced a definitive biography her fans will devour. It's titled Dearie, The Remarkable Life of Julia Child. Bob Spitz notes that young Julia McWilliams, her maiden name, was not born wearing a chef's toque. In fact, as the child of a prominent family in Pasadena, California, she grew up as a socialite with a bicoastal reputation for athletic prowess, good humor, and hard partying. One thing everyone agreed on, she could barely boil water. But her life changed with World War II when she landed a job with the government in the Far East and met the man who would be her friend, husband, business manager, and lifelong lover, Paul Child. Posted to Paris as a diplomat after the war, he took Julia to lunch at a famous restaurant where she tasted a classic French dish and fell in love with everything French. She argued her way into the men's classes at the famed Le Cordon Bleu cooking school, then collaborated with 2 French colleagues on a revolutionary cookbook for Americans that would take almost a decade to complete. In a world of hamburger helper, it became an immediate bestseller, and the TV show that followed, an experiment by a Boston educational station, morphed into a national phenomenon. Julia's unmistakable, near falsetto voice, good humor, enthusiasm, and ability to teach made her America's foremost culinary authority and one of its most recognizable women. Fittingly, when she died 2 days before her 92nd birthday, her last meal was a bowl of her own French onion soup. Bob Spitz is a journalist and author whose definitive biography of the Beatles was a New York Times bestseller. For his latest project, he took on a different kind of rock star. It's entitled again, Dearie, The Remarkable Life of Julia Child, and it's available from Knopf Bob Spitz, thanks for taking time to visit us on in Baltimore here on WYPR in the Midday Show.
Dan, it's my pleasure to be here.
I would say this book was so much fun to read, a dangerous book because it makes you hunger for and far too willing to put aside good sense in favor of a three-egg omelet made with scads of butter.
That's right. And as you said, you know, she's also a rock star. I mean, yeah. All through that book, she is a great character.
As one reviewer of your book noted, Julia Child has not exactly had an unexamined life. In fact, this reviewer wrote that Julia, quote, has inspired books, blogs, blogs about her books, and a movie about a blog about her book. Why this book and why now, Bob?
Well, it's the first definitive biography of her life. There have been others. There were over 1,000 Beatles biographies when I did the Beatles, and I realized that they needed something complete and definitive. Julia had never had a biography written about her that covered her entire life from birth to death. That, number one. Mm-hmm. And number two, in 1992, after I had met her, she had been engaged with someone who was writing her biography, who put one out, and called me and said, "Oh, dearie, you've got to help. You've got to do your book. They're making me sound as if I'm already dead." So it was imperative that I capture her spirit in the book, and that was what I really set out to do.
You know, only 3 years ago, as I mentioned, there was the successful movie with Meryl Streep about Julia's life, and you can still catch Julia Child's cooking shows on YouTube and on TV, and she's been gone for 8 years. So let's start here. What do you think is her enduring appeal?
Oh, well, I mean, you know, she's your aunt who comes over to the house and helps you write through a recipe. She is completely unintimidating. And her legacy also, and she mixes humor with food. She takes all the tension out of cooking. She allows you to relax, allows you to step out from behind the stove and take some bows and be the star in your own home. This is what Julia had always set out to do, just, you know, demystify cooking and allow anyone to do it in their home to have fun, and also to learn how to cook for your family or for whomever with the freshest ingredients, using age-old techniques to make something that's really delicious. That was what she set out to do.
You know, having seen her shows and listened to that unique voice, as we just did in that clip from, might have been the first show she ever did, the French Chef.
Yeah, it was.
The Boeuf Bourguignon show. You listen to that, you know, she sounds like upper crust, Brahmin, East Coast gentry. So I think a lot of people may be surprised to learn where she was born. So I mentioned California, but let's talk a little bit about her early life.
Yeah, Julia was a California girl through and through. She always felt that way. She loved the beach. She grew up on the beach. She grew up in Pasadena. And she grew up in a family that was very privileged. Her father was one of the town's leading lights. They had servants and maids, a swimming pool in the back, tennis courts on the side of the house, and a house in San Malo on the beach in addition to that. But, you know, the closest Julia ever got to the kitchen, I think, was being born with a silver spoon in her mouth. So, you know, taken in toll, that's the way she grew up.
You know, I mentioned at the outset of the show, 6'2". I see other references to 6'3" for Julia's height.
Yeah.
I just wonder, in doing this biography, could you determine how her height affected her growing up?
I can, and let's get a myth out of the way. She was 6'3" and a half.
Okay, thank
Julia
you.
Julia lied about her age. She always told people she was 6'1". Her brother John was 6'5", and her sister Dorothy was 6'6".
Wow.
So her mother always said, you know, I've given birth to 18 feet of children. But in fact, she cut inches off that, too. It was more like 20 feet of children. Height had a real important effect on Julia. She always stood out. It gave her some confidence where she had none in many ways. But also it kept her from having a lot of meaningful relationships. There weren't many dates in the early days. Guys didn't know what to do with a 6'3" woman, even though she was loaded with personality. And she had trouble buying clothes. And later on in life, she would have trouble, too, with the height because she carried a lot of weight, not bulk, but she was a big woman and a big bone woman, and she always had trouble with her legs.
When she went to college, from your book, it seems like she wasn't much of a student, and also, unlike her peers, not too interested in finding a husband.
Yeah, Julia majored in carousing, I think. you know, it was during Prohibition, and Julia had one of the few cars at Smith College in Massachusetts. So she had one assignment, and that was every night she would scoop all of her friends into her car, and she knew where all the speakeasies were. And they would go out and get smashed, really. Julia was the driver, but, you know, she could barely see when she got back. She had a lot of fun. She didn't know what to do with her life. She didn't know what to do with her life when it came to a husband. She didn't know what to do about finding a man. She didn't want to just graduate and get married like so many people in her class. So she did the only thing that a red-blooded woman in that situation would do. She joined the OSS.
Tell folks what the OSS, today it would be called the CIA, basically, right?
Right. It was the Office of Strategic Services. It was predated the CIA.
So what drew her to that, Bob?
Really, it was looking for anything. She wanted to help during the war effort. She went to Washington, D.C. It was one of the first offices she walked into. They were hiring smart college graduates. And Julia got a job for no less than with Wild Bill Donovan, who was the head of the OSS, and was a legendary guy. She got a job heading what she called the registry, and before she knew it, she was on a troop transport bound for Southeast Asia, 8 women and 2,800 GIs. And that's where the bulk of her war experience was, over in Southeast Asia, in Ceylon.
And what about after the war?
Well, after the war, she was as lost as ever. You know, Julia always called herself a social butterfly. It really distressed her. She felt she was a dilettante, nothing more. But yet she felt there was something unique about her. So she was always looking. She was looking for something more, something that would she could sink her teeth into. And it wasn't until she met Paul Child and he took her to that restaurant you mentioned earlier, where she discovered what really would be the backbone of her life and her legacy.
So he meets Paul Child, who's also working for the government, right?
Yes, he was. He was working for the OSS as well.
And they're based in Paris.
Well, after the war, interesting story, Julia wanted out. She didn't want to be a bureaucrat anymore. She wanted to find something that really meant something to her. But Paul worked for the State Department. Where does he get stationed? In Paris,
nice.
Of all places. They couldn't believe their good luck. He spoke fluent French. He had lived there before.
And they made a trip to Rouen.
Yeah, they landed at Le Havre, terrible crossing from America. Paul was afraid of flying, so they always took ships. And they made the drive to Rouen. Paul had a Michelin guide. He knew there was a restaurant there called La Couronne. It was the oldest restaurant in all of France, in the bottom of a hotel lobby. And he said to Julia, you know, I'm going to really introduce you to French food. He had talked about it all through the war. French food this, French food that. She had heard so much about it. She was worried that it would be a letdown. And when they went in, he ordered sole meuniere for her. Sole, just the way God intended it to be.
Goodness.
Cooked like an omelet in Normandy butter, you know, just perfect.
Some parsley. And, don't forget the parsley.
Exactly right. And a little lemon. And when Julia put that first forkful of sole meuniere in her mouth, she really became Julia Child for the first time. She knew that something had changed her life, and that was it. That was the moment that did it. For the rest of her life, she called it the most important meal of her life.
For an instant, Bob writes, there was sweetness of a kind she had never experienced before. Butter, perhaps, but more full-bodied, like a butter bomb with a smoky, scorched tang. An instant later, the sea, probably a briny fish fume with a splash of white wine. Wait, a faint, lemony whiff drifting by, now gone. That was the epiphany. for Julia Child.
You bet. And Paul topped it off with a little wine on the side. Wine? Julia had never had wine with lunch. In fact, the only wine she ever had was, you know, a $1.29 bottle of Almadine, a huge jug from the West Coast. But never at lunch. This was the most extravagant thing she had ever seen before. They had a great Chablis, and that, again, that did it for her. Changed her life right there.
Bob Spitz is our guest in this hour of midday, author of a new biography of Julia Child, who's arguably the world's most famous cookbook author and became America's first TV kitchen superstar, even though she was pushing 40 before she picked up a spatula to do anything more serious than fry a couple of eggs. We'll be right back for more of this story with Bob Spitz.
I'm chopping onions for French onion soup. We're going to brown them in butter and simmer them in stock and then gratiné them like this. This is French onion soup, exactly the same kind you get if you were in Paris, France, and you can make it yourself.
And welcome back to Midday. Dan Roderick's here. Bob Spitz is our guest, author of Dearie, The Incredible Life of Julia Child. And if you're like so many of us who like to cook and can't think of Julia Child without smiling, you'll enjoy this book thoroughly. Now, Bob, I want to get this out front. Biographers are supposed to maintain some level of impartiality about their subjects. So
I know what's coming.
Yeah, well, it does say, you know, you say toward the end of the book that you developed a crush on Julia Child when you traveled with her for a magazine, for an assignment for a magazine. And by then she was, what, pushing her 80s or in her 80s?
Yeah,
anyway,
she was
80 forgiven.
Years old.
Yeah, she had an eye for handsome young men, I think, right?
Julia loved men. She loved men all her life. And her niece told me a really interesting story. Julia, when she was 90, loved to go to the movies almost as much as she loved young men. So her niece took her to see Brad Pitt in that film he did, Troy. Oh. And Julia kind of talked out loud in the movie theater. You know, she was in her 90s, and she would just talk out loud. And, of course, if you were in that theater and you heard that voice, you knew, oh, Julia Child's in the theater. So they had been watching the movie, and she kind of woke up from a brief nap, and she nudged her niece. Now, remember, she's 90, and she said, you know, that Brad Pitt is such a gorgeous young man. And she took a breath, and she said, I wonder what's under that toga. You know, Julia was a hoot. Julia, even at 90, young men, that was right on her plate.
When was the first time you met her?
I was in Sicily. Again, it was in 1992. I was working on a number of magazine articles for American magazines, and I got a call from a friend at the Italian Tourist Bureau who said, look, I know you have some extra time on your hand. Would you mind being an escort for an older woman? And I said, hey, lady, you know, I don't do that kind of work. And she said, oh, you know, it's too bad. It's Julia Child. And I said, hey, I'll be right over. Julia was traveling around Sicily. She wanted to taste Italian food, which, by the way, she didn't care for. And she wanted to see an old friend of hers. And she wanted an arm to hold on to because her knees were giving her trouble, and I happened to be there and be that arm. So I really got to spend almost a month doing nothing but talking to her about her life. You know, she was at that point where she was willing to reexamine her life and also consider her legacy. So I was in a fortunate position to work on this book.
Indeed you were, Bob. Bob Spitz, our guest in this hour of midday. Dearie is the book, The Remarkable Life of Julia Child, weighing in at more than 500 pages, but a delight to read. So, Bob, I want to talk about the development of her book, her first book, the one that made her famous, Mastering the Art of French Cooking. This took quite a while. How did it happen?
Julia kept getting dragged to embassy parties because her husband was, you know, a rather low-level bureaucrat, and she was the bureaucrat's wife. So one night, just when she had had it up to her eyeballs and she didn't want to do anymore, she went to one and was introduced to two French women who were sitting there. One was Simone Beck, who became her lifelong friend and collaborator, Simca, and Louisette Bertholle, another diminutive blonde. And they were trying to publish in America kind of a pamphlet, French Cooking for American Homemakers. And it wasn't very good. They couldn't get anywhere with it. They didn't know what to do. What they really needed was a collaborator, an American collaborator. And voila, as they say, Julia was raring to go. She had been at Le Cordon Bleu for almost a year and really knew her way around the kitchen. But more than wanting to be a chef or a cook, Julia really saw herself as a cooking teacher. And she thought this would be the perfect vehicle for her to collaborate in. And she signed up to help those women get their book published.
So what year is that, and how long was it before the book was published?
Yikes, what year was that?
It was like caught
me off guard.
It took most of a decade, I think, is right?
Yes. It was about 1951.
Okay.
And they didn't get the book published until 1961.
Right.
So, yes.
So about 10 years. And it seemed like publishers weren't interested in this kind of book in the U.S., but somebody along the way said, you know, I think this is the one. This could be the breakout cookbook.
Well, actually, they were interested. Houghton Mifflin had signed on first. They thought it was great, and they gave them, I think they gave them $750 to do the whole book, and including all the food for all the testing of the recipes, all their time, all their efforts. And they worked on it for, I guess, about 5 years. Julia turned in the 800 pages of the work.
Wow.
And it was only two chapters, sauces and poultry. And when Houghton Mifflin saw that, they freaked out. I mean, basically, that's what happened. You know, Julia was in her encyclopedic mode. And Houghton Mifflin kind of felt, wow, you know, what we're probably going to get here is 3,800 pages, and we can't possibly publish that. So they abandoned the book. And after all this work, you know, Julia was so dispirited. By this time, she and Paul were living in Oslo, and yet she said, you know what? We're going right ahead. We're going to scale it down. We're going to change the whole concept. She pushed Simca to really work hard, and they resubmitted it to Knopf, which happens to be my publisher as well.
Wow.
To a young woman named Judith Jones, who she was, I think, the only woman working at Knopf at the time, the only female editor. She was the lowest person on the totem pole, but she had discovered a book on her own a couple years before, Diary of Anne Frank. And so she was kind of a rising young star, and she was also working with a new author named John Updike, who was just publishing his first book. So Judith, who loved to cook, who had lived in France for a while when she discovered the Anne Frank book, knew right away when she saw this that this was the book. And she convinced Alfred Knopf, who didn't want it at all, really wanted nothing to do with it, to let her have the book and to publish it.
That's what I meant, the resistance that you described there and then the acceptance of it. And then it becomes a hit. And Julia Child,
well, actually,
she travels around the country, and all this must have been kind of a shock to her that she would be mobbed at cooking demonstrations and book signings.
Well, yeah, she had absolutely no idea. Knopf had told Judith Jones, if a book called Mastering the Art of French Cooking ever sells, I will eat my hat. And, you know, they really had no great expectations for it. They thought maybe it will sell, you know, a couple thousand copies, maybe for a few years, and that would be it. But what really did it, of course, was in 1963, Julia winds up on television, and that changed the entire game.
Before we get to that, I wonder, Bob Spitz, if you would sort of paint a picture of the American foodscape at that point, food and American culture up to that point, and what it was that made this a hit. What do you think? America was ready for this? They were into things French. There was the Kennedy administration. It was early 60s.
Please
well,
you, talk about
yes,
that.
Yes, all of those. Yeah. But you said it best at the top of the show. You know, you called it the Velveeta belt.
Yeah.
Which, by the way, I loved and I intend to steal.
Okay.
But really, the trend at the time was quickness. You know, live your life the fast way, the quick way, the easy way. So American women were cooking casseroles, you know, hot dog and bean casseroles, tuna noodle casseroles. My mother was the champion of these monstrosities.
Mm-hmm.
Sorry, Mom. Mrs. Paul's fish sticks.
TV
you know,
dinners.
All the TV Swanson's TV dinners, exactly right. And there was also a woman on TV who was called the can opener chef. And actually, she was on the Today Show for a while. So that was the trend at the time. But you're right. One of the keys was John Kennedy's election. Jackie was steeped in everything French. They had a French chef in the White House,
right.
Rene Verdun. And also, it was getting easier to travel to France. You know, prices were coming down. Planes were getting better. All the servicemen had come home after the war with tales about French cooking. And so there was this electricity in the air, and it all fused when Julia Child enters the picture. And basically, she knew what women were cooking in the home. She knew that it wasn't very good and decided that if she could just get them interested in doing something a little bit more, something that would really please their families, then she could change the culture of cooking in America. She really believed she could do that.
Bob, there's two things I want to ask you about. One is the detail in the book, her book, Mastering the Art of French Cooking.
Right.
I mean, it's really amazing, yet it's not tedious. Would you agree with that? That you read those recipes, they are highly detailed. If you follow them exactly, you'll be just fine, folks, right? But they're not tedious.
No, that's exactly right. Although I will say that they're complicated. It's not,
yeah.
You know, Julia wanted to do master recipes. Her French chef cookbook, which came out a few years later, was almost like the Cliff's Notes version of Mastering the Arts. But they're not tedious. And Julia developed a new way that you would list all the ingredients down one side of the page and have the recipes on the other so you could see what you need at certain times and you wouldn't get all flustered in the kitchen. That was another way she wanted to change the way people worked so that it became easier. It was, as I said earlier, to take some of the tension out of cooking, which was threatening for a lot of people.
Right. And then we get to the TV show, and this is the other thing I wanted to ask you about, because I've just been marveling at these videos just the last few days. I mean, the old TV show, The French Chef, the early
right.
60s, in black and white, in a kitchen that included a washer and dryer behind her, I think. I noted that the other day.
Yeah, probably. Yeah.
But, you know, here's this woman, tall woman with this kind of a strange voice, falsetto voice, wielding a meat cleaver, wielding a knife, and occasionally throwing off, pronouncing something with a beautiful French accent, and taking her, but doing it all in about a half an hour, pulling off these dishes with some ease, and the enthusiasm is there, certainly is there. But it must have been a little strange for people at first to see this very tall woman with this kind of a strange voice cooking on TV and sipping wine.
Well, that was part of the attraction, you know? She was almost a comical character. She made mistakes all the time. And in fact, I will tell you on the QT that I would say 95 or 99% of the mistakes Julia made on TV were made on purpose. She wanted viewers to see, you make mistakes in the kitchen. Now, here's how you correct them. Even I make mistakes.
Hmm.
But you know, Julia was, she was a natural. She, at the beginning, and I heard it when you played that first little segment from her show, you can hear her kind of gasping for breath. That was one of her problems at the beginning. But she settled down very quickly, gave this a try. And you're right. People weren't used to seeing such a big woman on TV. In fact, the crew that worked on that show, they didn't know how to light her. They didn't know how to mic her. They didn't know how to scale the kitchen so that she wouldn't tower over the counter. All of that had to be taken into consideration. This was a complete game changer. You know, nobody had ever seen anything like this on TV.
And we should also point out her age at the time she started doing all this. She was in her late 30s at Cordon Bleu, and then the book.
Oh, no, much later.
Later than that?
She was in her 40s.
She was in her 40s.
Julia, the great, you know, Dan, the most amazing thing about that I found when I started writing this was this, that Julia Child couldn't boil water until she was 40 years old. She couldn't cook until she was 41 years old. She had never been on TV until she was 50 years old. In fact, she didn't even own a TV when she was 50. So this was a woman who came along at mid-age and completely reinvented herself. And, you know, it gave me a lot of hope. There's hope for all of us.
Yeah. I would say I was very impressed with the early videos from that show. I know there was rehearsal, and I know her husband, Paul Child, was involved in the development of the cooking show. But I'm just very impressed. She seemed to take to it with great ease.
Well, you know, she had no blueprint. Like I said,
she
didn't own
a
TV set.
Yeah, she's a pioneer, a true pioneer.
Absolutely. So they just said, would you like to do a show? And Julia said yes. And this is what she brought in. I mean, she and Paul kind of concocted it in 15 minutes in her kitchen. And when she went on, there had been a little rehearsal, but not much. So that first show where she did Boeuf Bourguignon, 28 minutes long, she had to wing it. And what you see, the whole Julia Child phenomenon was right there in that very first show.
And if you want to see it, I just want to mention to our folks who are listening, it's on the Dan Roderick's Facebook page. I posted, I think, the whole episode of the Boeuf Bourguignon, the first episode. If that's not it, then it's French onion soup. If that's not it, then it's the omelet show.
Bob, yeah, all of them are the early ones.
They're wonderful. They're great. Yep, they're wonderful. It made me want to get the DVD set of some of those shows and enjoy them again. We're speaking with Bob Spitz, who's the author of Dearie, The Remarkable Life of Julia Child. We take a little break here on midday, come back and talk some more about the life of Julia Child with Bob Spitz. A short break.
Here is the standard classic omelet. It's flat and it's French, and it's very lovely and tender and soft, and it's just really like just lightly coagulated eggs with a little cloak around holding them together. It's actually the perfect kind of an omelet, and it's perfect as a quick meal, and it makes a lovely little lunch with a green salad. And we're going to do all kinds of omelets, plain omelets, cheese omelets, omelette aux champignons, and so forth. And we're even going to have a dining room party with omelets. All you need to make an omelet is a hot fire, and you need a bowl, and you need some butter, and some salt and pepper, and some eggs. Then you have to have the right kind of an omelet pan.
Julia Child, that's the omelet episode of The French Chef, a new biography, time for the centennial of her birth this year. Julia Child's book, Mastering the Art of French Cooking, redefined the notion of fine food for a generation of Americans. It convinced them there was art and science to their most common household chore. Her cooking show helped turn educational TV into a public broadcasting powerhouse. The author of this book, Dearie, The Remarkable Life of Julia Child, is our guest this hour, Bob Spitz. And we should talk for a moment here, Bob, about Julia Child's impact on public TV, on educational television.
Well, I'll tell you an amazing story that never fails to completely flabbergast people. When Julia went on the air in 63, there were a handful of public TV stations. And basically, they were little outposts around the country, none that were related to another. They didn't know each other in any way. And you had to tune them in to get them. You couldn't just change the channel. You had to tune the outer ring on. And basically, what they did was they showed the lectures of professors at community colleges during the day, maybe a public meeting in a certain place. If there was a local symphony orchestra, they'd put that on at night, but without any commentary, no announcers, no slickness to it. When WGBH put Julie on, they got the bright idea of taking a tape of the show and sending it to one or two of the other stations saying, hey, you know what? You might want to consider this and put it on. And if you like it, just put it on. And when the next station did that, there was one in Texas, one in Rochester, that was the beginning of the public TV network. It was called NET, National Educational Television. That was what launched PBS. It was Julia Child's show. It wasn't, this was before Mr. Rogers, before Sesame Street, before Masterpiece Theater. Taking that tape and sending it to another station was the beginning of syndication and the beginning of a network.
Bob, you mentioned the can opener cook who would make appearances on the Today Show. In this landscape of TV, was there any other, were there any other cooking shows on TV?
Oh, there were. There were cooking shows on almost every station in America at that point. And they would be, you know, little kind of what I call Hey Gals show. They take a magazine recipe and make it on the air. And a lot of it was, you know, making a Jell-O mold and you know, putting sliced carrots in the Jell-O mold or little marshmallows.
Nothing on Julia's level.
Nothing at all. I mean, this was really the first serious show that where you could make food that really was of French, you know, culinary quality, and yet without any of the tension in it, as I said before. So, you know, this was the first big one. And it was really her personality that did it. You know, Julia came along at a time, and there were plenty of performers before her, but Julia Child became a star just by being herself on TV. And that's what really captured the public's imagination.
And she wasn't a snob. She insisted on certain things, using butter. We don't use that other stuff,
yeah.
Right?
Right.
You didn't get the feeling of her being elitist, even when she would knock off a French term here or there, because she was the French chef, so she got to do that, right?
Exactly.
Here's an email that came in before the show today. Why Julia Child appealed to me. Donna writes, she wasn't a snob. She was a devotee of In-N-Out burgers, even had them snuck into her hospital room. So, of course, as soon as I dropped my bags at my Petaluma Hotel, I zoomed over to an In-N-Out to taste what all the fuss was about. Oh, my, I would seriously fly clear across the country to eat that again. After gulping the burger down, I went to Whole Foods. But first, I'm a sentimentalist, and I still have the receipt from this. Anyway, that's a reference to a hamburger joint, and it's true. I saw Julia Child cook a really good hamburger on TV once.
Well, she did that, but, you know, every Saturday morning when she was older, she would go to the farmer's market in Santa Barbara. And then afterwards, her ritual was to go over to Costco and have two hot dogs. I mean, you know, that's what Julia liked to do. When we were in Sicily, we ate, you know, a lot of fabulous Italian food. And when we got back, Julia said to me, you know, the whole time I've been over there, I've been thinking about a certain restaurant. Can I take you for lunch? And I said, yeah, sure. You know, she said, when we get back to the States. And we did. We went. And we both had Big Macs and large fries and a Coke. So, you know, Julia loved French food and was devoted to it, but she got down and dirty when the situation called for it.
What did she think of the French fries at McDonald's?
That was why she went. Are you kidding?
And she thought they were pretty good. Okay.
Well, she did, except when they stopped making them with beef tallow, Julia lost interest in them, and she moved elsewhere.
Well, speaking of that, that gets me to a question I wanted to ask you, Bob. I followed Julia Child's recipes for several years. I make the coq au vin recipe in her cookbook. That right. Begins with the instructions, brown the bacon in butter. That's how it begins. So you know you're not eating in a health food restaurant when you have a recipe like that. So I just wondered, how did she deal with the change in American attitudes toward French food, toward rich French food, this reputation that the French food has as being rich? And do you think that hurt her popularity at some point?
No. Julia never cut corners at all. In fact, one person said to her, Julia, you know, I can't make your recipes. There's all that butter. And she said, oh, dearie, don't you worry. Just substitute cream. You know, that was Julia's way of thinking. No, Julia felt that food had to taste good and it had to be rich. But her rule was that if you ate everything in moderation, you could eat whatever you wanted. She didn't believe in you know, doing away with the butter or doing away with cream or even cutting down on meat. She just ate less. You know, she didn't stuff herself at the table. And that was part of Julia trying to change the culture as well. Americans would sit down and eat gargantuan food. I mean, you know, we're having that problem now. Michelle Obama is at the head of trying to change people's attitudes towards stuffing themselves at the table. But she felt that if you just ate in moderation, you could have something made with butter. You could have a glass of wine at the table. You could have a dessert. Just don't gorge yourself. And I think she was right.
By the way, speaking of the wine again, I referenced this before in the 60s when she would sip the wine at the end of a meal that she had prepared. And the video of her making French apple tarts is the one that's on our Facebook page that concludes with her cutting herself a piece of this apple tart, dashing it with some cream that's spiced with a little Calvados, and then drinking some wine with it, you know, saying right. Bon appetit and drink some wine. Was this controversial for educational TV in 1963, 64?
It was not just controversial for educational TV. It was controversial for all TV. And I have to tell you, she took a lot of heat for it as well. She got there was a lot of mail that came into to WGBH at the beginning. People were appalled. They called her a drunk. They assumed she was just swigging food on the air and swigging alcohol on the air. And of course she wasn't, but she wanted to Americans to see that when you have a great meal, a wonderful glass of wine highlights that. And she refused to compromise. She had a glass of wine at the end of every show. And this was at a point where, you know, people weren't, nobody drank wine with dinner in those days. I mean, it wasn't done. So this was something that she had seen in France that she wanted to introduce to the American public. And of course, in the next couple of years, that's exactly what happened. People, you know, she introduced the phrase bon appetit. No one said bon appetit when they ate at a meal. But Julia brought that as well. So she was, as I said, not just changing the way we eat, but the way we live.
Something I wanted to ask you about her personality. She was a teacher. When in this part of her life, she was a very good teacher on TV. Teaching people how to cook in the French way. And I would see it would seem to me a very good organizer, too, that she was real hands-on when it came to the TV show, how things were presented, demonstrations that she may have done. Would you call her a control freak? And at any time, did she turn people off with her precision, her insistence on precision?
Well, as you said, she was precise. She was relentless about the way she cooked. But no, she never did turn people off. She was never pushy. In the kitchen with all the people who helped her, it was always compatible. The women who helped her over the years, and that cast changed often, became her friends. They loved working with her. It was like, you know, it was like a sorority in there. No, Julia had a very relaxed way in the kitchen. And in fact, when you came to her house to dinner, Julia never cooked. You cooked for Julia. She would tell you what was in the refrigerator, and then she would stand at the side and she would have one of her famous reverse martinis and a handful of her favorite Pepperidge Farm goldfish. She ate them her entire life before dinner. And you would cook for her, and it was always relaxed and convivial. So the only way that Julia was a control freak was the way she wrote recipes. She was relentless that they be correct. She called it the scientific proof. And, you know, before she would make a meat recipe, she would write to the Department of Agriculture to find out how much fat content there was in a certain cut. The Department of Fisheries was her favorite pen pal. I mean, Julia would, if she wanted to do a roast chicken recipe, Julia roasted 50 roast chickens, and she roasted them every which way, trussed, untrussed, stuffed, unstuffed, at every single temperature you could think of, you know, massaged lovingly with butter, without butter, on a gas range, on an electric range, so that when it came time to do a master recipe, it was perfect. And that's as much of a control freak as she ever was.
you know, she had such a long life and such a busy and long life and stayed very visible to the public till nearly the very end. Am I right? She had that series with Jacques Pépin on TV, and
in the late '80s.
Yeah, and she came to Baltimore several times, visited restaurants here, did demonstrations or book signings. So she stayed healthy a long time and kept going.
She did, and you know, when you calculate all the, you know, the bacon first fried in butter, you know, you and all that wine, it kind of leaves you agog, but. You know, Julia lived a very active and a very long life. She loved her life. It gave her a lot of pleasure. She never thought that it would come her way. And once it did come her way, she worked very hard to keep herself in front of the camera. And you could see how much she loved cooking. I mean, she did that bit with Jacques Pépin when she was in her late 80s. And people said, oh, you know, how can you parade that old woman in front of the camera? Well, she was a hoot. You know, everybody loved that show. And she was determined to go off, you know, if they had to carry her off. And that's basically what happened.
What were her final years like, Bob?
You know, they were kind of pleasant. They were in an old age facility in California, in Santa Barbara. She discovered a lot of her old high school girlfriends who were living there as well. She ate breakfast with them every morning. It really disturbed her because those women she found were all Republicans, and she was a lefty liberal. But they found, you know, a meeting ground, and she had everybody who came through the town, every cook, every chef, every politician. They all stopped to say hi to Julia, and she would pay them to sneak her out of that facility and take her to a good restaurant at night where she could get a good steak and a glass of wine.
You tell, we're short of time now, Bob. This hour has flown by, but you tell an amusing story about her award, the Presidential Medal of Freedom.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, she had always wanted Bill Clinton to give it to her because he was a real he-man in her eyes, and he was a Democrat, but it came through George W. Bush. Who, you know, Julia was distraught that she was going to have to accept this from him. And he called her at home and gave it to her. And she found him completely delightful. You know, she forgave him for being a Republican. She forgave him for all of that and was happy to get it in the end. It justified everything for her.
If we have about a minute left, Bob, if you were to sit down for a Julia Child meal, what would you like?
Oh, for me, it's definitely the beef bourguignon. I make it all the time. You know, it's kind of classic. It's a great winter dish. You can do whatever you want to it. You know, you can throw in mushrooms, you can throw in onions, you can improvise a little. It has that great bacon taste, and it's got Julia Child written all over it. So I always go back to that, although I have to tell my daughter it's called beef stew for her to eat it.
But with a good helping of wine, of course.
Oh, you bet, without a doubt. Tribute to Julia.
Bob Spitz's book is Dearie, The Remarkable Life of Julia Child. Bob, it's been a pleasure to have you with us. Thank you so much.
My pleasure, Dan.
And we conclude the way Julia always concluded on The French Chef today.
That's all for today on The French Chef. This is Julia Child. Bon appétit.
Julia Child is co-author of the book Mastering the Art of French Cooking.
Midday is produced by Nikki Gamer and Sean Yoes. The associate producer is Michael Himowitz. Our board operator is Tom Welch. Our interns are Nathan Glover, Sean McDonough, Mikkel Moore, Julian Tolliver, Kayla Williams, and Ren Droege. Music produced by Jeff Truman and High Gravity Sounds. Midday podcasts are available at WIPR.org. Dan Roderick's column appears Tuesday, Thursday, and Sunday in the Baltimore Sun. This is WIPR, your NPR news station.